The year, 1978, and even Russians didn't play this much roulette. The movie, Deer Hunter. Hey everybody, welcome to Unspooled. I am Paul Scheer. Amy Nicholson and I are both on vacation this week, which is why it sounds like I am recording this on a phone, because I am. I am actually in a closet in North Carolina. Amy is in a film festival in Korea, but we did not want to stop the podcast from getting into your ear holes on this 4th of July week. We're going to be talking about The Deer Hunter, a movie in which Amy and I had some interesting thoughts about. But before we get into that, I want to talk about Do the Right Thing. A lot of you brought up that you were disappointed in both Amy and I, and we take that very personally, that we didn't bring up that Radio Raheem's love and hate speech was actually a reference to the Robert Mitchum film, Night of the Hunter. I've never seen that. I want to see that. I'm sorry I didn't recognize that. Amy, I'm sure, has seen it. But, you know, we got into such an intense conversation that it may have just eluded her. We'll get into it a little bit more when she is back in town. But let's talk about what Kenman 8943 brought up. Kenman says, as you predicted, Futurama did reference Do the Right Thing. During the Mother's Day episode, there's a robot uprising and riot, and a trash can robot throws himself through Sal's pizzeria window. There we go. Win one for Futurama. If we don't get it in Simpsons, Futurama is there to save the day. Also, Sal Mascali writes, my biggest criticism of Do the Right Thing is that Danny Aiello doesn't know how to make a pizza. I know a lot of people brought that up, that Danny didn't look like he was actually making a good pizza, but Danny did train. He said he learned how to make a pizza. Also, just a shout out to Kate Littleton, who's running our Facebook group. She is doing an Unspooled scavenger hunt. Go to our Facebook page right now to check that out and find out what that all entails. I'm not even quite sure just yet, because again, I am on vacation, but it sounds awesome. Griffin Newman, who hosts an amazing podcast. If you've not listened to Griffin's podcast, Blank Check, you're missing out. He was also a guest on this show for the Academy Awards episode. Wanted us to know that You Got a Friend in Me is a go-to for him at karaoke. So he wanted us to know that those types of people do exist. And you know what? I have to say, after Amy ripped apart Randy Newman, I have been listening to a lot of Randy Newman. And I need to point out that we now have Randy Newman's Faust t-shirts available in our Tee Public store. That's right. You can go to teepublic.com/stores/unspooled. I love our shirts there. If you have not checked it out, go check it out. They are pretty awesome. And a big shout out to Kim Rulo and the Pittsburgh Unspooled group out there, the big meetup that they had this week to go see Do the Right Thing. So thank you, Kim. Thank you, Pittsburgh. We love you. And last week, I thought that it would be fun to ask everybody here who listens to the show to tell us what they think Deer Hunter is about, because it's a movie that I've heard a reference, but I've never actually seen. So I wanted to know what you all thought Deer Hunter was about. All right, let's go to the calls.
The Deer Hunter is a reimagining of Bambi from man's perspective.
Hi, yes, I believe The Deer Hunter is about Bambi taking revenge on the hunter who killed his mother.
Deer Hunter is a sequel to Bambi told from the perspective of the man that killed Bambi's mom.
It's a musical retelling of Bambi in the style of Wicked, and I can't wait to see how the Russian roulette scene fits in.
Yes, The Deer Hunter, Michael Cimino reimagination of Bambi from the hunter's point of view.
I like that you think the main character in this movie is a deer. Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, they're not deer. Okay, anyway, let's get into it. Let's find out what Deer Hunter is actually about and if it's actually as good as people say. I mean, does it deserve to be on this list? We will get into it onto our feature presentation, The Deer Hunter. It's 1979 and trendy kids are walking around town while listening to tapes on their Sony Walkman and wearing Lacoste alligator polos while sipping on the cool new soda, Mellow Yellow. Michael Jackson releases his Off the Wall album, marking the debut of his solo career. Nickelodeon and ESPN launch their networks. Margaret Thatcher is the first woman elected as British Prime Minister. China institutes a one-child-per-family rule, and Iraq's president resigns and his VP, Saddam Hussein, replaces him. The YMCA sues the Village People. Sid Vicious overdoses and Pink Floyd releases The Wall. People are bopping to the Bee Gees, Gloria Gaynor, and the Eagles, and they're watching Happy Days, MASH, and Little House on the Prairie on TV. Audiences are loving Alien, Superman, Kramer vs. Kramer, and The Muppet Movie, and of course, today's film, Deer Hunter, which was rated number 53 on AFI's 2007 list, up a whopping 26 places from the 1997 list. You hear it in my voice, already shocked. Amy, who's in it? What's it about?
The Deer Hunter. It is written and directed by Michael Cimino, an assist from Derek Washburn on that script. It is about a community of young men who live in a town called Clairton, Pennsylvania. It's a steel town. Act one of them, Steven, gets married. Act two, three of them, Steven, played by John Savage, Michael, played by Robert De Niro, and Nick, played by Christopher Walken, are in Vietnam, and they learn about Russian roulette. Act 3, Mike and Steve come back, try to make the best of life back in Pennsylvania, while wondering how can they ever get Nick back, that's Christopher Walken, if he's still alive.
So, Amy, I've never seen The Deer Hunter. I've heard about The Deer Hunter. The Deer Hunter seems to be said in the same breath as The Godfather. It's one of these quintessential 70s films. And I have to say, I don't like this movie.
Whoa, that is definitive.
Yes, I will talk about it. I think there are some things I really like about this movie, but I can't lie to you and even engage you on the sense that I like it. There are things that I like about it, and I'm happy to talk about it. I would love you to sway me on it, but I had a real negative reaction to this movie. I'm like, what is all the hubbub about, bub?
This might be a very special episode. The one episode where I like a super masculine Vietnam film slightly better than you.
Really?
Wow. Who would have thought?
Wow. I mean, so out of all the Vietnam films, this one you like the most.
This one has some of the best highs and some of the worst lows. When this movie is bad, it is bad. When this movie is really wonderful and confident, like in the first third of the movie with the wedding scene in the small rural town, I think this movie is beautiful. I love the way this movie introduces us to all of the characters, lets us learn about them through this gigantic set piece where we're just watching people dance and drink and look at each other and get into fights and who's making eye contact with who. I should also say I'm a little bit biased because I mentioned before I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church.
Right.
But like Greek and Russian churches kind of like trade places in small towns. So my parents got married in a Russian Orthodox church and the pictures look a lot like this. So there's a little bit of me that's like, oh, I know this world a little. And it's lovely for me to see it on screen.
You know, I think there is something really engaging about this film in many ways. Like, it's beautiful to look at. The deer hunting scenes are really exquisite. And you're right, that hour-long wedding sequence is really dense and you don't see this in cinema and you get to exist with these characters. It felt to me that this whole movie can be accomplished in less than 2 hours, what we're telling and how we're telling it.
Because you sound like a producer on The Deer Hunter because they all wanted it to be more like that.
Well, there were two cuts of the film, right? And I guess there is a rumor or a legend that Michael Cimino, the director, bribed the projectionist to stop the film midway through so he could like skew the test scores so the longer version tested better than the shorter version.
The rumor I heard is that Michael Cimino wanted the film to be exactly 3 hours and 3 minutes long, which it is, because he wanted it to be as long as Gone with the Wind, specifically.
Oh, God. And that's what this whole film feels like. It feels like I'm just doing it because I can. I'm making them dance until they literally fall down. That wedding scene, they play it in the end credits. Like, you know, De Niro falls down exhausted because they've been dancing for 8 hours. We talked about Rosie Perez, you know, in that opening dancing and Do the Right Thing. Here is another director just going like, dance, do this, do that. It just feels like masturbatory. That's how I felt about this whole film. I'm like, okay, I get it. I get what you're trying to do,
but like the guys singing to each other, which is a thing. I'm a man. I've been around a bunch of men. We never like break into song.
You don't. Like, you never get out a good, I love you, baby.
But like, I mean, I get those, you know, those little tingles. My spider sense goes off when I even see it in movies like Beautiful Girls. It's like you're trying to create this family. You're trying to do all this stuff. And I don't necessarily fully buy it. Like, they're just like slapping ass so much at the start of this movie. I'm like, oh, what are we doing here? What are we doing? I don't know. It just rubbed me the wrong
way. That's interesting. Maybe I don't have as much of a male friendship bullshit detector. Like, maybe you can see things in here that seem really phony, the way that I look at you, that show Euphoria that came out, and I'm like, no, this is not how female high school culture works. Maybe I'm a little bit blind to like male dynamics of friendship in here, because I'm also just so in love with Christopher Walken in this movie that I really can't fathom. A part of my brain just shut off and it just stares at him. I mean, this is a movie that builds up this beautiful, perfect, wonderful man to torture him. It's like creating a work of art just to burn it. But when he's on screen, I'm just like over there staring at maybe the most perfect human being on the planet, besides Michael Shannon.
And I do not disagree with you, Bai. You have a type. I do not disagree with you at all. I think this is one of the best Christopher Walken performances I've ever seen. And he has a career of great, insane, engaging performances. And this, you know, obviously is very early in his career. This is kind of what makes him break out. He wins the Oscar for this. I think I like the bones of this movie. I just don't like all the fat around it, because I think it actually dilutes the power of it.
That's so fun. This is how I feel about Apocalypse Now, but not so much here.
Wow. Okay.
Huh. I wonder where that's coming from. I feel the wankery in Apocalypse Now.
Right.
But here, even though I know that Cimino is called a wanker by most people who worked with him, I think he did have British producers, so I feel like somebody must have called him a wanker.
Sure.
I think I'm so absorbed in getting to see such a specific community, a specific one that's not like, we're all American, you know, like corn-fed baseball types. I think I just so appreciate that we're here, even though the here that he created is really fake. It's like bits of Ohio mixed with Washington State.
Well,
There's no glaciers in Pennsylvania, but...
Again, it feels like what you were saying about Coppola. Like, here's a guy who didn't go to war, who's fantasizing what it's like to go to war. We'll get into later on how this movie really puts a spin on Vietnam that is just not true. But I don't think that's the point of the film anyway. But I would really argue that De Niro, who did, you know, go to a steel mill to research his character as a guy named Bob, you know, he feels real and grounded. But the movie reeks of... This is what I think people in a small steel town are like. Yeah, right? Yeah. We got to get more in touch with the steel town. Oh, yeah, they're talking about their bullet. Oh, they're talking about their beer. They love Rolling Rock beer. That's what they like, because they're from Pennsylvania. They drink Pennsylvania beer. Like, you know, it's like that kind of shit that I'm like, it just feels like Hollywood coming there and doing it. And again, I wouldn't even point to a performance I don't like. I don't think I can say that. I just don't like the whole world of it.
I mean, that's fair. Like, I heard that Cimino, like, he grew up a rich kid in New York. You know, nothing against some of my best friends, I'm sure, grew up as rich kids in New York.
Sure.
But that what he would do is, like, he would hang out with, like, the poor delinquents, like, the crazy people who would walk around New York with guns when he was in high school, because he thought rich people were so boring.
Oh, wow.
So there is an element in him of, like, wanting to suck up adventure and suck up danger, which... You know, kind of like you pointed to Apocalypse Now. Remember how we talked a lot in that episode about John Milius just basically making up what war was like? That's basically Cimino. He was like, when I was going through and reading all the research on The Deer Hunter, you know, I was at the library. I was going through the microfiche because I'm a microfiche.
Yeah, I love that.
I was going through the microfiche. And the first thing I found about him was like this piece from the New York Times. It was like, oh, man, yeah. He signed up as a medic. He was with the Green Beret. He did all of this stuff. He was like, you know, there like around the time of the Tet Offensive. And I was like, whoa, wow. Okay. So Cimino's got some legitimacy. And then as I kept reading through the microfiche, I got to the ones where they were like, no, that is absolute bullshit. That did not happen. We fact checked this. No.
Well, basically, he just didn't say no. People assume things and then he alluded to things, right? Like,
oh, man, yeah, I've seen some stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy. The fact that his career even continued after this, and I know it didn't continue in great success, but like right now,
Heaven's Gate, if y'all wanted to hear the word, yes.
Yes, I mean, there you go. I mean, but it's like, he didn't do anything to refute these claims, and his co-writer on the film said he's a pathological liar. But to his credit, his co-writer did say, but if he wasn't such a liar, this movie would never have been made. I mean, so here's a guy. The truth of Michael Cimino is he enlisted in the Army in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War and was part of the Green Beret Medical Unit, but never was deployed.
Wait, I think that's actually the lie. I think he's actually enlisted in 1962.
Oh, you're right.
Much earlier.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
He's also a guy who lied a lot about his age. Like, he was born in 39, but he would say he was born as late as 52 later on in his life.
That's crazy. So I'm even having trouble making sense of the lies. So here he is. He only served for 6 months and he was never in the special forces.
By the way, while they're at this wedding, there's this moment where they talk to a Green Beret, or they basically kind of yell things at him, expect things at him.
Right.
I have to admit, listening to this scene, let's listen to this scene for a second. There's only one thing in my mind. Do you know what is on my mind?
Oh, well, I was thinking that maybe this is like a spinoff of Richard Crenna's character from the Rambo movies, and he was coming to take De Niro with him to Vietnam to finish some unfinished business. No, what was on your mind?
It was a little video game I love very much.
That's hilarious.
I had to look it up. I do want to say, I actually looked, I was like, what is that song? And it's a song called The Korobaniki.
Okay.
And what The Korobaniki is it's a folk song. And the folk song is also, I think, kind of symbolic about everything, as is everything in this movie. It's about a peddler who convinces a girl to hook up with him by, like, giving her a ring.
Oh, wow.
And then he's like, I'm going to come back. I'm going to marry you. I'm going to go sell some stuff. But as he goes and sells some stuff and makes money, he gets murdered and never comes home.
Well, you know the whole thing? If you got past, like, 120 levels on Tetris, you would die.
What?
Yeah, it would just automatically kill you. It was original Russian roulette. But this whole sequence is really interesting. And again, just going back to the Green Beret who comes in, why is he there? Who goes and crashes a wedding? Like, he's like, that was the only bar he could find open, the bar in the Legion Hall. That guy's got some problems.
And that guy is basically who Mike is. Because when he gets back, he never takes off that outfit. He's always wearing his fatigues. He's always doing it. I actually love that scene when he's back when Axel gets stuck in the bowling machine.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, everybody's like, oh, no, what do we do? And Meryl Streep is wearing Christopher Walken's bowling shirt. And the camera just follows him. It, like, pans along as Mike, like, runs to the rescue down the bowling.
Yeah.
It's like a fireman scene.
Let's just go back a little bit and talk about this film and the origin of it, because it didn't come from his personal experience. It came from an unproduced screenplay written by Garfinkel and Redeker about Las Vegas and Russian roulette. And it was called The Man Who Came to Play. And the script was purchased by Michael Dealey, who hired Michael Cimino to do rewrites with Derek Washburn. They took the Russian roulette element and they placed it in the Vietnam War.
So it was Russian roulette first.
It was Russian roulette first, which makes sense because this movie is
like
heavy.
A Jason Statham movie.
I mean, it's heavy Russian roulette. I mean, Vietnam is a part of it, but Russian roulette, I think, is the real through line of this movie. I mean, to a point where I was laughing at it at the end. I was like, what are we doing? What are we doing?
It didn't even occur to me, though, right now. Is this a Russian community because it's Russian roulette? Since he, like, backdated all of the plot?
Amy, I guarantee you that's the level of research
that went into this. Is this why there are the people being like, Пожалуйста, let's do shots, is so he could get away with them playing Russian roulette? I feel obligated to mention now very clearly that my parents, despite being married in a Russian Orthodox church, did never play Russian roulette. I just want that on the record.
Look, I mean, you know what, Amy? They may have, but they may never have told you. They may have just been the lucky survivors of the Russian roulette. They carried this dark secret inside of them. Well, look, you said, like, did he maybe place it there because of, you know, the Russian culture? And I would say that it wouldn't be surprising, because Derek Washburn said that him and Cimino just got together in a hotel room and broke this whole story over 3 days. They didn't interview a single veteran, and all they did was watch TV, and they said, oh, you know, those combat cameramen in Vietnam, they were out there in the field, and we got what we needed from watching that.
Well, this is why I think it's really important to talk about these type of histories here and in Apocalypse Now, because I think it is really, really important to say that a bunch of people get their history from movies.
Right.
And I think a lot of people get their ideas of Vietnam from Apocalypse Now and From the Deer Hunter, written by two bullshitters.
Right.
And so it is, I think it is always worth sort of raising a flag and being like, what we picture war being like is made up by people who wanted to dream up the most fucked up stuff.
That's why I like Oliver Stone with Platoon. And when you get into it, you're like, oh, this feels like the most real portrayal of that war because he was there. He was actually there.
No, I mean, to that point, like this movie, The Deer Hunter, comes out 3 years after we left Vietnam. You know, this is not even history to people, basically. It's like living the story of what just happened.
And do you think that people go into it going like, this is what it must have been like?
I think the people who saw The Deer Hunter when it came out were like, this is sort of great manipulative bullshit, honestly.
Really think that people saw through it?
I think so. I think a lot of people, like, there were tons of articles in newspapers about how this was a fake, how this was a phony, how, you know, Michael Cimino didn't really have the right to tell this story. And then, of course, going very hard on Russian roulette, which we'll be getting to later, I'm sure.
But why was it, like, received with open arms?
Well, it was received with a lot of mixed reviews, to be honest.
Okay.
Like, I didn't have a hard time finding a negative review of this one. I mean, there were a lot of rave reviews, a lot of glowing reviews. There were a lot of defenses. This was basically a hot take movie of this era. When this movie was showed at the Berlin Film Festival, there were huge walkouts. You know, the Soviet delegation left because they were mad about the treatment of the Vietnamese. So then a lot of, like, the communist bloc leaves. You know, these Germans, the Cubans, Bulgarians, everybody leaves. But there's this infighting. You know how, like, we fight so much about, like, the Oscars and people trying to take down each other's films and sniping them? This conversation was happening this year about this film, you know, because one of the producers of The Deer Hunter was like, actually, that walkout was started by Julie Christie, because actually Julie Christie was in this movie directed by Warren Beatty called Heaven Can Wait that everybody also thought was going to win the Oscars. Like, so she was trying to start this bad faith thing. I don't really know if that's true either.
So you think that, like, this created, like, a snowball effect, and then that kind of reached out to Vietnam veterans, because they also are protesting the film as well.
Yeah, I mean, when this movie shows up at the Academy Awards, there's people outside with signs. I think like 13 people get arrested protesting this film at the Oscars.
Yeah, they're throwing stones at the cars and they're holding up signs that say no Oscars for racism. The Deer Hunter is a bloody lie. And there is a violent scuffle between the police and these protesters. That's how angry people are. So much so that Robert De Niro didn't even want to sit in his seat at the Academy Awards. He wanted to sit backstage because he thought it was too crazy. And the Academy said no. And so he said, all right, I'll set this one out. And he just stayed at home in New York. It's interesting to me because it is spoken about in a very, like, this is American cinema at its best. You know, Roger Ebert, who I often agree with, you know, writes a very passionate review of this film. You know, he loved this film, and it's some great performances, some great camera work. I love the way Cimino, like, uses the camera, that you're kind of, you know, you're seeing these, like, long wide shots, and you're you know, you're behind cars. You feel like you really are being voyeuristic. I think with the wedding, that wedding sequence is amazing. It just doesn't feel worthy of film. Like, it feels to me like, cut that down to 20 minutes, not an hour, and then you have a film. I also am confused by some of the characters. Do you understand what was going on with Meryl Streep, who is completely wasted in this movie, and only really in this movie because she was dating John Cazale,
who plays Stan, one of the guys who stays home.
Also excellent in the film.
Yeah.
But at this,
I mean, John Cazale's this guy who came from theater. He made, I think it's like, he made 5 films in 6 years and all of them won Oscars.
Wow.
Like, he just entered, blew up Hollywood.
Yeah.
And then died of lung cancer when he was 42.
And he's sick here in this film already. And the only reason why Meryl Streep took the part was because they were together as a couple and she wanted to be near him. So she does this oddly basic part. I mean, she's always amazing to watch, and I love her in this movie as well. But it's surprising, like, when I saw her in the film, I was like, ooh, we're going to get to see some good Meryl Streep stuff. But it's a very serviceable role. I mean, she's doing everything she can, but it's not that much on the page there, I don't think.
Well, what I think is really impressive, I mean, she's brand new to Hollywood at this time. Yeah. You know, this whole movie's basically starred with New York theater people. Like, everybody in this movie is a New York theater person.
Right.
And so it's one of her first roles, and she gives these interviews even at the time. Like, even at the time, which I think is kind of a big deal, where she says, I wouldn't exactly call this a strong woman's part. The fact is that this is a man's story, and my character is called upon to be there. Strong and supportive for the man, and that concept is not anywhere close to my personal values. That she hated being a sad housewife. And actually, if people are really interested in this a lot, I really want to recommend, you know, Karina Longworth, past guest, best person ever, like
lover,
host of You Must Remember This. She wrote a book on Meryl Streep, and her first chapter is all about the Deer Hunter. And she has this line that I really love. She calls Meryl's performance in this, quote, an act of subversion that passed as submission, that she played this role who was really passive, but she put so much humanity and life into it that you understand that this character is so much more than even the movie gets her, that she kind of steals all these scenes, which I think actually, you know, in a way, Cimino, to give him credit, he watches her. He puts the camera on her face. He lets her have these moments.
She just is engaging to watch. And again, like I said, the part is a little bit underwritten, but she pops so much. And back to this question I wanted to ask you, what is your understanding of who she is? Is she, and I was really confused about this in the film, so is she married to that guy who punches her in the face and then also dating Christopher Walken?
No, I think that's her dad.
Oh, man, I was so confused because I know that she was in a relationship, but I thought like, okay, that makes sense. But but by the way, her dad doesn't look that much older than the guys. At least the guy who owns the bar. Don't know how I missed that. And I also have another question that I'll get to
There are like a lot of kind of shady, mysterious things happening under the surface that the movie doesn't quite tell you, which I respect. But this whole plot of, you know, this wedding that we have between Angela, who we're going to have on the show in a bit, Rutiana Alda, she's our special guest today. Angela being married to Stephen, John Savage. She's pregnant. We know this very casually from like a tiny scene we get of her, a glimpse of her in her wedding dress in the mirror touching her belly. His mom even knows that she's pregnant. His mom, who's very protective, very Russian, basically barreling into scenes, says, you know, she's not such a thin girl, if you know what I mean. But then you have Stephen saying he's never slept with her. So the whole movie is this quiet thing of like, who is the dad for real? You know, like, is it John Cazale, who seems to be like around her a lot, by her side a bit? The baby's also super blonde. So is it like Christopher Walken's? Is it anybody else's?
I know. There are these like moments. And that's where I think I really enjoy the film, in those quieter moments. And I think, you know, those, that kind of the tension underneath this town. Like, I love when, you know, I'm jumping ahead, but when De Niro comes back and doesn't go to his own party and you're seeing everybody getting ready for the party. And, you know, there are these, just these little quiet things. I mean, I do love that monologue, the This Is This monologue.
Hey, Mike, let me borrow your spares, huh? Your extra pair?
No, Stan.
No? What do you mean, no?
Just what I said, no. No means no.
Some fucking friend. You're some fucking friend, you know that?
You gotta learn, Stanley. Every time you come up here, you got your goddamn head up your ass.
Maybe he likes the view from up there, huh?
Every time he comes up, he's got no knife, he's got no jacket, he's got no pants, he's got no boots. Oh, he's got that stupid gun he carries around like John Wayne. That ain't gonna help you.
Oh, what the hell, Mike? Give him the boots.
No way. I ain't giving him no boots. No more. No more. That's it.
You're a fucking bastard. You know that? Huh?
Stanley, see this? This is this. This ain't something else. This is this. From now on, you're on your own.
Like, that to me is just, I feel like I get more of the friendship there. It feels like a real moment. I don't know. I think that the, you know, the underbelly of this, you know, like, I think you're supposed to understand like, oh, these are carefree guys and they go to war and they come back and they're broken. But I think I would argue they're broken before they go to war.
Well, and I would argue like that scene is trying to set up this idea that Robert De Niro's Michael, he's set up to survive because he's just the hard ass. He's just on it. He's with it. He's sharp. He's focused. He's kind of the protector, and he's also kind of the punishing dad in that scene. And there's also a second thing that happens in that scene that I think is really interesting, which is one of the characters, I forget if it's Axel or the other one, eats a Twinkie dipped in mustard. And
oh, I love that.
I just brought you something.
Oh my gosh. Is it a Twinkie dipped in mustard?
Okay, it's not a Twinkie. I couldn't find one, but it's a donut with mustard. Right. Are you going to eat it?
Will
you
I
eat
will.
It?
Will I will
eat
definitely it? Eat it.
Are you going to eat it now?
I'll do it right now. Here we go.
Okay, I'm
all
ready.
Right.
I'm excited.
This is not the same thing. Not bad.
Not bad?
No, actually, it's actually not bad at all. I'll do another. Yeah.
Can I try?
Yeah, please. Yeah, it kind of the sugar and the tartness, it works together for me. I would.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's not bad.
It's okay.
By the way, I love that we've come into trying food that our characters were talking about has done on the show. Because I also have another food-based thing I want to talk about later on. I'll just say it now. I got obsessed with one scene when they go to the kitchen in this movie. And they're having this, like, you know, this big moment in the kitchen. And the kitchen had the most fake food on the counter. It was like, they clear, like, it doesn't read like a kitchen. It's like, we'll just put a stalk of celery down and three eggs and a loaf of bread. It's like, this is a bar kitchen. Like, when are you using these three ingredients? Like, it's the dumbest thing. But just to go back to this idea of setting up Michael being the hard ass, you know, the guy who's going to survive. You're setting up against John Cazal, who doesn't go to Vietnam. So it's a weird dynamic. Like, and when I'm watching this movie, it feels like, I don't know if they wrote him out because of his sickness, but we're setting up something with these two characters and with him very much in the top of this film that I don't think pays off at all.
You know, that's interesting because I feel like one of the things of this movie is that literally every line in it, every moment of it feels very like heavy-handed. Like, mm-hmm. This means this, this means this. I mean, from the very first speech that we even hear Robert De Niro say when they all exit the steel plant in the morning.
What the hell is that?
Where?
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit, you know what that is? Those are sun dogs.
What does it mean?
It means a blessing on the hunter sent by the great wolf to his children.
What the fuck are you talking about?
No, it's an old Indian thing.
You're full of shit.
Stanley, would I shit you about something like that?
Yeah, there's just, they're blessing the hunter is a blessing that doesn't seem to take. Because if there is anything this movie says, it's that being a good hunter doesn't save you at all in Vietnam. I mean, especially if this is your philosophy to
well,
be.
Well, doesn't it though?
No.
He's the only one who really gets out unscarred. He's the only good hunter.
Yeah, but the way he acts in Vietnam is actually him betraying the way that he feels like he should be acting. Because before he goes to Vietnam, he gives this whole speech about what it means to kill.
One shot.
Two, it's pussy.
I don't think about one shot that much anymore, Mike.
You have to think about one shot. One shot is what it's all about. Deer has to be taken with one shot. I try to tell people that. They don't listen.
But to get out, what we see him do is like Rambo-style machine gunning. Like, his philosophy of one shot does not save him.
Well, okay. I disagree with you wholeheartedly here.
Okay.
Because, I mean, he's taking the one shot metaphorically that he has to survive, which is, I'm going to put three bullets in this gun and we're going to fucking shoot our way out of here. They have one chance to live a life. Not like, I think it's a metaphor for what he's doing. And he has three bullets to take out an entire reserve. It's not like he comes in guns blazing. It's like that mentality of the one shot, not the easy way out, doing things, you know, with more difficulty, with more precision, is exactly the only reason why he is alive. I mean, you know, even when Steven breaks his leg after that fall, carries him on his back.
I like your interpretation because, like, to me, I was thinking of it more as, like, a bullfighter code. Like, have you ever been to a bullfight?
I have not.
I've been once. I don't totally recommend it, but sure. It is very different when you're there. You realize, like, oh, okay, my ideas of what this is are totally wrong. I don't need to ever do this again. But they do have this code of, like, the one stab,
mm-hmm.
where at the very end, after you've gone through all the rituals, you know, and this is also itself a movie about rituals, after you go through all these rituals with the bull, the thing you're supposed to do very last is you take your long sword, you're supposed to go up to the bull, you're supposed to stab it once right between the back of the shoulder blades, and it's supposed to die immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't, the crowd starts to actually turn on the bullfighter, which I think is really interesting. So I guess that's what I was thinking he was talking about here, is this idea of, like, the graceful kill, which does not work when you're in a war as messy as Vietnam.
Right. And I think he's glorifying killing on some level, right? Like, he can't kill the deer at the end of the film. I think he doesn't want to take anybody else's life. You know, I think before, when there were no stakes, it was easy to put these rules on it. But I also believe that he is the only guy ready and prepared to survive. Like, he is in his right gear. He does have his right gun. He does have the bullets. You know, he's not like John Cazal, which I think would have been so much more interesting if that relationship there was with Steven instead of him. But
that's true. That would be the right fix.
Yeah.
It'd be Steven instead of him. Because, like, Steven, it's like, you're not prepared. Like, even here in the movie, when he, like, gives this whole lecture about, like, you know what? Forget Steven.
Right.
It's up to us now. To me and you. What about Steven?
Forget him.
Forget him?
Forget him. You're gonna make it.
Who do you think you are, God?
Look at him. He's in the dreams. He ain't coming to us in the dreams.
Mike, what are you saying?
I'm saying forget him, Nick.
get it through your head or you and me are both down too.
I mean, I think in a way he does think of himself as God.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's God with that deer that he decides not to shoot.
He is a flawless soldier. He is never fazed. And which brings me to my question I wanted to ask you. Is Robert De Niro in this movie a Vietnam version of Atticus Finch? Is he too perfect?
Whoa.
As much as I enjoy Robert De Niro's performance in this, and I think he pulls off a goatee better than basically anybody besides...
Oh, I think it looks so awful.
Oh, really? You don't like that angel heart look?
No. I mean, and I'm sort of down with the ginger beard, but not here.
I do like it.
But yeah, I mean, there is something in this character that, you know, it's like the complete 180 from Taxi Driver, from his character there, who's like all nerves and bubbling and simmering. I think what's interesting about Michael is almost the worse things get, the calmer he gets. You know, he's just sort of there and he's focused, which I do believe happens. I do believe that, like, you know, when something awful happens, there are a bunch of people who, like, something in us clicks over and we're, like, very calm. Like, I will tend to freak out about the littlest thing, but if something big happens, I'm always like, here we go.
And is he basically calming down Steven in that moment where they're both looking outside of the, they're in this, like, cage underneath this hut and, you know, he's whispering, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Just think about something. Like, he's walking him through, relaxing. Is Steven reacting just to the Russian roulette upstairs in such an extreme way? I couldn't quite tell why he was. I mean, I guess he's just having a nervous breakdown knowing that he's going to be next.
Yeah.
Every click of a gun means.
Because they are like psychologically torturing them. I mean, like, there's that scene where the guy just sort of blasts a machine gun into the water pit just to keep them on edge. You know, where they start yelling like, come on. I mean, but I do think Michael does have some flaws, which primarily among them being like he's convinced he's always right. You know, later on when he sees Stevie at the hospital, he's like, you're leaving here. And Stevie's like, I really like it. And he's like, you're leaving here.
Yeah, but I mean, he should take him out of the hospital. Stevie doesn't want to be in that hospital. I mean,
Stevie likes the hospital. Maybe we're supposed to be like layering One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on the hospital, but he just got to meet Princess Grace. Looks great.
Oh, I thought that was a lie.
You think?
Yes, I think he's trying to lie to him and say, like, hey, everything's going great. Like, he lost both of his legs, and he's trying to put on this brave face. I love that scene because it's like this moment of these two guys who've been through hell, and he looks so downtrodden and depressed. And the minute he hears his voice, he perks up, and you see this, like, life come to Stephen's face, and you know that Stephen has to be like, in my opinion, my life is great. You saved me. Like, it wasn't, you didn't fuck me up. But this is a guy who left his wife. You know, his wife is alone. She's essentially catatonic, you know, and all stemming from that one little thing, you know, in the beginning. You knew this probably. I did not know this. But in a Russian Orthodox wedding ceremony, you drink out of this goblet. There's two sides of a goblet. And you're both drinking. And if a drop spills on you, that's bad luck. By the way, I would lose that in a second. That seems impossibly hard. Everyone's good. But yeah,
and by the way, that also seems like incredibly heavy-handed.
Oh, yes. I mean, 100%. So she gets two little drops. No one even sees it, but she gets two little drops.
I love that no one even sees it, that everybody just starts applauding like they did.
Yes. So you have this moment where he's like coming to life, and I think I felt like he was lying. I don't think Princess Grace is coming to that hospital. It looks like a really dumpy hospital.
She's a princess. You got to do a lot of stuff.
Okay, well, maybe you do. I will take it.
Also, wait. I think actually Princess Grace is from New York or Pennsylvania?
Okay. All right.
Now I'm going to be like a Princess Grace truther. She's from like a rich family somewhere over there.
All right. Well, I will take him at face value. But he wasn't in that hospital because he needed to be. He was there because he was hiding out. He couldn't go back to his life. So in a weird way, you know, De Niro is right again. I need to take you out of here. You don't belong in here. You don't need to be in here. You are hiding from your life. But
De Niro's also projecting, because here's the thing that he does throughout the whole movie. Mm-hmm. He's like, you, stop hiding. Come home. You know, he does that here to Steve. He tries to do it with Nick. That doesn't go very well. But he does the same thing. He doesn't confess it to people, but he skips his own party. He knows himself firsthand that you don't want to go and face your community, that people don't want to, like, look people in the eye and try to explain something they can't even explain. He knows that. But instead of, like, talking about it or dealing with it, he just projects it onto other people. And he's like, I gotcha. I'm still the same man. We're fine.
It's interesting. I think this movie is so muddled in what it's trying to say, because I also will look and say, I love the fact that, you know, he has this, like, kind of father-son relationship with Walken. Or at least, I mean, I know they're about the same age, but it seems like Walken looks up to him. And, you know, he really guides Walken through this moment where, with the Russian roulette moment, and he can't save Christopher Walken at the end. He can't save him. Like, Christopher Walken has descended into essentially madness. And
yeah, let's hear a little bit of that mad voice, yeah. Can we? I just love, A, that you still hear the Walken in the Walken.
Yeah.
And yet it's
beginning
also,
of Walken, yeah, baby Walken.
Baby Walken.
You know what's me? It's Mike. Tell me it's Mike. Tell me it's Mike.
It's Mike.
Tell me it's Mike.
It's Mike.
Mike. Mike who? Mike who?
Hey.
Mike who?
Mike who? I don't know.
Yeah, there's this glazed look in his eye, and he's gotten so much thinner.
He only ate water, rice, and bananas, so he can look that kind of hollow and vacant. I mean, but by the way, that's a very Christian Bale-y type of thing to do, you know? It's like, but he does look like a skeleton of himself, you know?
Oh, the beautiful Walken who's like on the dance floor at the beginning of the church. To see him like emaciated like this with the dark veins that I guess imply he's been doing heroin or something like that.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, again, some stuff left unsaid. I mean, in that whole moment when Walken spits in De Niro's face, like that's such a, I mean, again, you talk about heavy handed, like you spit in my face, you know, that's what people say. He actually does spit in his face. And that was an improvised moment, which is why if you watch De Niro, he does seem genuinely shocked at that. You know, I think that basically the rumor has it that De Niro almost walked off set. But this is the way that I think Cimino ran this set. Like, we're dudes. We're making movies about men. And this is what you fucking get in there. You know, like, he wanted all his slaps to be real. And those slaps. I mean, as much as I'm, like, having fun with this movie, I can literally say that Russian roulette scene is masterfully done. And both of them, even the one where Walken walks in to find the Russian roulette, like everything. And
even the one where after Robert De Niro comes home and he puts the gun to Cazale's head, where I heard there was actually even a real bullet in that gun, that De Niro's like, it'll be more real if we have a real bullet
and
here.
This and this is Cazale the bullshit like, that I hate.
Come on. And there was a real gun, but Cazale kept like triple checking it to be like, can we please, like, if we have to do this, make sure it's not near me?
But here's a guy also who was dying of lung cancer. You know, he dies before this movie even comes out. So then you're talking about this other thing going on behind the scenes where it's like, I'm going to put a real bullet in here. And he's like, I'm freaked out. You're going to really shoot me? Like, what the fuck is going on here? But it just seems like machismo in every sense of the word. I mean, putting a live round in a gun and shoving it in his face like that. It does. I mean, every time a gun goes to a face, you know, you feel it. And I think I love that that John Savage's character, you know, can't even put it really to his temple and just kind of shoots off a little part of his head.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about that moment where Stevie can't really shoot himself in the head is like there's this mixture of emotions that I think the film is setting you up to feel like, I'm glad he's alive. Also, he's a pussy. Like, I think you actually are supposed to feel both in that moment.
Yeah, because it's like De Niro would have had more respect for him if he blew his own head off. I do think so. I think because, like, you watch him, like, coach him through it. It's okay. You're a man. Show him what you're made of. Show him you got balls. You know, it's like, it's a crazy thing. Can we break into the Russian roulette of it all, too? Okay, so this movie.
Fire away.
I mean, this movie is, click. Okay, so this movie is obviously centered around these scenes of Russian roulette. And there was no Russian roulette. There was no Russian roulette in the Vietnam War. That was not a thing that was happening, right? If anything, you could argue that this movie created more instances of people doing Russian roulette than the Vietnam War had of people doing Russian roulette.
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing. Going back and like reading all the original clippings of this is like when this film came out, in the first year or two, there were 11 people who died because of Russian roulette.
Oh,
and I like people who had seen The Deer Hunter in theaters, came home, tried it out.
Wait, it's like that stupid thing. Remember that movie, the football movie where they laid down in the middle of the road and then all of a sudden fucking people are laying down in the middle of the road. It's like, you fucking idiots. What the fuck are you doing?
I mean, it was like all the people who tried that were men. What? I don't know what it is about men, but they were like male of the male species. And they were all there between the youngest was 8.
Right.
The oldest was 32. And then this conversation all happened. Like, what is happening? How do we stop this? What do we do about this movie? And it happened again, like, really loud a couple years later when they decided to put The Deer Hunter on TV. And when they put it on TV, they were like, maybe we should edit out the Russian roulette scenes.
Well, then there's no movie, right?
And there's no movie. Like, what do you do? You can't really edit out the Russian roulette scenes. So they didn't edit out the Russian roulette scenes. And a couple years later, the death toll had risen to 28 people who were, like, watching the movie and shot themselves watching it.
So I'm a kid of the 80s, right? That's when I grew up as a young child. And everyone spoke about Russian roulette growing up. Like that was a...
It was like the quicksand of our childhood.
Yeah, it really was. And the idea, like I remember having toy guns and doing Russian roulette, like with cap guns and stuff. Like that's only because that's older brothers telling younger brothers. It's, you know, it's trickling down. It's a crazy, crazy thing. Like in a way, your takeaway from this movie is like, you're a man if you can fucking do this. And they're like, and they become slightly like superheroes. Like there's a thing with Christopher Walken. I know it's all, you know, averages and whatever, but he does it click, click. It doesn't, you know, he's alive for
like 6 years of doing this?
Just fucking playing Russian roulette. Like
making
like,
hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars and sending them home to Stevie.
What the fuck? And how does he
how
even know where Stevie
is? Yeah. Can we talk about? No.
I mean, it's so crazy. I mean, it's a crazy thing. So it's like, we can't even talk about what we saw there because it's so fucking scary and dangerous. But yet we're making it as really cool. And I think that this movie, I do think it glorifies violence. I think it glorifies Russian roulette like in a way that is problematic.
Well, yeah. And
even the outfits that they're wearing.
They're pretty cool.
I mean, they are cool. I mean, by the way, I'm not. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It glorifies it.
But yeah, I mean, there's that moment where, you know, the first time that you see Christopher Walken forced to play it when he's upstairs right before they break out. And you see when he pulls the trigger and survives, you see him actually get a little bit happy. You see the sort of like rush of like, oh, I did it. And it almost makes it seem like you did heroin for the first time. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of like an addictiveness to it. And then what happens from there is, well, first about that scene, you know, the man leading it, they shoot him like he's a person with just nothing behind the eyes.
Right.
You know, all the people they're picking on from the Vietnamese and then later the Chinese, like by the end of the film, it's the Chinese who are running these parlors for some reason. And the Frenchman, the Belloc,
right,
who's like, what is fun? Blah, 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 blah. I have all the money you want in the world.
Behind all the closed That's doors of the Russian roulette yeah. clubs. But by the way, I love it.
And then by the end, it's the same thing. You have all of these just sort of blank faces. You have death being treated so cavalierly. Actually, even early on, people are like bleeding from the head and someone puts a sandal on the wound.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, here, that'll stop it. It makes you really think about how we lay out violence in order to get the audiences on our side. I mean, even from our very first attack here in this movie, like the very first thing we see once these dudes land in Vietnam, when we go from this musical shock, by the way, let's play a little bit of that musical shock just to be like, here we are, it's a musical shock. We're going to Vietnam. So once we've gone from bar nocturne indoors at night to daylight bombs, what we see happen is you see a Vietnamese soldier take a grenade, kill a bunch of women and kids. Then one of the women and kids in this hole survives, climbs out, holding her baby, screaming mm-hmm. and crying. We see that man shoot her. And then you see Robert De Niro flamethrower the dude. And the movie's kind of setting it up to be like, yeah, the first time you see Robert De Niro kill a person, that person has just murdered a bunch of women and a bunch of children. They make him do the worst thing possible. So that when he's violent, we're totally on his side. Like, his violence in this movie is always 100% justified by the actions that we're seeing everybody else do around him.
And, I mean, I would argue, too, that the Vietnamese soldiers are portrayed so villainous. Like, to a point, you know, this is not a one-sided war. I mean, you know, like, I mean, we can get into the nitty-gritty of Vietnam, but it's sort of, like, presented like if you were to watch this movie and have no idea what the Vietnam War was, you'd be like, we had to go in there. These are the most evil motherfuckers you've ever seen. Like, there's not a single Vietnamese soldier we see that isn't almost mustache twirling. You know, it really is. It's aggressive, and I think that's another reaction to the film and why people were against it.
Why they called it racist?
Yeah, I mean, you get that, and I'm not trying to be like, I'm not living in cancel culture. I'm not trying to be like, you know, I think this movie for the time period is just like, it's sending a lot of weird mixed messages. It feels as sloppy as a 3-hour length leads me to believe. It's like, there's a lot of good stuff in there, but no one kind of just carved it away. It's almost like, oh yeah, that's a good beginning of a statue, but you need to make sure that you carve it all out here because what you're saying is sloppy.
Well, and when you have things in here, like to the movie's credit, it does show like the terror of the civilians trying to leave the town. It shows them trying to leave Saigon at the end when the war is over in 1975. But then you also cap that off by having like a news anchor, like a real actual news broadcast inserted in here being like, they're all trying to leave. This is the end of the war. This is the end of Americans here. And I do think when you put in real news broadcast like that in the middle of a film, it makes all the phony parts seem realer.
Yeah.
And I think that is an actual problem. That's why I really hate it when like American Sniper, to pick on that movie again, is like, we're a true story, because it isn't. It isn't at all a true story, but it's taken as truth. Other things that happened when this movie came out, like Bert Schneider, the guy who was the producer of Easy Rider and Five Easy Pieces, he saw a screening and he called it a sacrilegious piece of shit. One of the guys who helped like produce the movie was punched in the face because of it. Wow. He was punched in the face by a Vietnam expert because he was so upset. And the guy who was punched in the face said actually that did make him slowly turn around on the film that he had created. He said that like he would probably have made a different movie today and that he would have been more careful about the Vietnamese people and that we defamed them and I regret that.
Once again, we're looking at something that I think is a problematic thing that we're coming to all the time. We reference it almost always. A lot of these directors that we've talked about are making these movies, these classics, these epics, under really strenuous situations. It's almost like, to make a movie about war, I gotta like treat you like you're in war, even though I've never been in war. So it's almost like someone play acting what it would be like. You know, we're going to be on the Titanic. We're going to actually sink a fucking boat. You know, I want this dance sequence and Do the Right Thing to feel, you know, desperate and angry. I'm going to make you desperate and angry. You know, here we have Cimino literally, you know, having these guys get slapped across the face, you know, relentlessly. Like you feel it like in the film, like how many times they're getting slapped across the face. Now imagine on a day when they're shooting this, growing angrier and angrier. Like they have them in these cages with rats in the cages. They're doing their own stunts. Like that whole
apparently actually when Stevie yelled, "Michael, there's rats in here," he was yelling for Michael Cimino, not even the character Michael. And they just kept in that cut.
Well, it's like, I think that he kept in a lot of that stuff. Like, apparently the moment where Walken, you know, blows his brains out at the end and De Niro is like shaking him and, you know, which you'd never really do to a person who gets a gunshot to the head. You don't want to shake their head.
FYI, if that happens.
Yeah, don't shake their head. It's not helping. But it's improvised. I think they were capturing all these moments, spit on them, hang them down. Like, and even that amazing 30-foot drop into the river, you know, when they're being rescued by a helicopter. It's nuts. They shot that 15 times in 2 days. They almost like killed the people in the helicopter. You know, it's like, it's this kind of like reckless filmmaking where it's sort of like, we need to be in hell to make something that feels like hell. And I feel like I bristle at that. And I can look at someone like a David Fincher who is very exacting. And I think David Fincher is almost like the Pixar of that. He wants a performance the way he wants it. He wants your hand to go up. He wants your head to go left. He wants you to say it in the right tone. And I don't think that that's torture. I think that that's the agreement that you make with him. This, it feels like, I need you to be beat to shit to act, you know, and that's the only way I trust you to give a good performance.
Well, you know, it's not a great movie unless your prop master gets malaria, which happened.
Oh, jeez, of course.
But, I mean, what you're getting at is something I do find really, 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 really interesting and that I love that we've been able to do through the show is I feel like it's just sort of in our gut nature. Maybe it's the way that we are trained. Maybe it's the way people talk to us about film growing up. But you're like, oh, that was a really hard shoot. It must be a great film. And it just, it's somehow like this knee-jerk reaction. It's like somebody hit your knee, your funny bone. You're like, oh, everybody was fucking miserable and it was terrible and the guy was a real tyrant. Must be a classic.
Right.
And I don't, it's just, the two are tied together and I want to untie them.
I think that we think of hard work is synonymous with a job well done, right? And that's not always the case. I mean, again, like, let's just be real. We're actors, right? We make pretend. We dress up in costumes. We get makeup on our face. We say our lines multiple times. We go home to our nice houses. Like, I mean, like, really, like, that's what we're doing here. Like, you know, and I think there's a lot of actors who aren't doing that. And they're doing, like, weird, you know, theater pieces. And I'm just saying, like, you know, very avant-garde things. And that's one thing. But this is a major movie. This is a movie that cost $15 million. It was only supposed to, I think, cost $8 million, but it went over budget when they, you know, went to Thailand to shoot. And all of a sudden, all the equipment they had to be used in a coup. And then they went back. They killed a couple people with the equipment and then gave it back to the production. Like, so many things went on here. But I do think there is something very bizarre about this mentality. It's something that we see very much in the 70s, and I think these are the people that are voting on this AFI list.
I agree.
And that's why this thing is moving up in the list. Like, what contemporary have you talked to where people, like, reference Deer Hunter? I don't feel like our contemporaries talk about this movie this way.
I mean, what I think is so interesting is kind of exactly what you're saying. Like, I honestly believe a tiny bit, just a tiny bit mm-hmm. of a reason why this movie is on the list is because there was this defensiveness about even getting it on air, because it was sort of like pushed down because of the actual suicides that happened in mm-hmm. here. You know, there had to be like letter writing campaigns. It was like a little bit Save the Deer Hunter. It became an event because it was finally on TV. So it could go and be The Ring, you know, for right. all the kids who actually should just not have access to guns in their dad's house. And I think there's that defensiveness of like, I must defend this film, that makes people elevate it higher, that makes people think like, I will prove that we were all correct in loving this.
We're talking a lot about these Russian roulette scenes, and I feel like I would love to play this clip of Christopher Walken talking about how he prepared for this.
Well, there's a particular section of the film that has to do with the first Russian roulette sequences, which is tough stuff. And when I got there to shoot that, I didn't know what was going to happen. I was worried about it because I knew it was a very important part of the film, but I didn't have any ideas about it, you know. And we were sitting there, and Michael Cimino decided to have the Viet Cong leader, the man who was playing the Viet Cong leader, start to smack us across the face. And if you've been smacked across the face a dozen or 50 times, you don't have much trouble acting. That's all I can say. That the things in the film are very authentic. There was a man standing there smacking me across the face. And I didn't have any trouble playing the scene.
Did you want to hit back?
Of course I did, but I knew that in the long run, a year later, I would be glad for having done that.
I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting about Walken's character in particular in this movie is that there's kind of a Sophie's Choice thing happening, right? You know, Michael is in the water with Stevie and with Nick. Nick gets on the helicopter. They're trying to get on the helicopter too, Michael and Stevie. But then when Stevie falls, Michael decides, you know what? I'm going to go with Stevie. I'm going to make sure Stevie, who's the weaker one, gets back alive.
Atticus finching it.
But what you see is like what happens to Walken when he's left alone, because he doesn't descend right away. Like, he's actually kind of okay. He can't remember his parents' birthdays, which mm-hmm. is difficult. Sorry, Mom, I forget your birthday a little bit.
I mean, I could never remember the year, but I could give you the date.
Yeah, there's this sort of lovely, a little bit heavy-handed, patriotic moment.
Are you Nikonar Chabotorevich? Can you understand me, Nikonar? Are you Chabotorevich? Are you sure? Uh-huh. Chabotorevich, is that a Russian name?
No, it's American.
All right, let me see your name tag.
But it's the being alone in these moments that I think is finally what makes him wander off and makes him sort of get destroyed. Like, he starts wandering off through, like, the party streets at first, right. Which kind of look a little fun. Then he goes to the strip club where you're hearing this Gladys Knight song playing that, like, I love this song very much. This is one of my favorite songs. But it also, the lyrics themselves seem chosen because they are about what's happening in this film. They are about what's happening. And just this like sad routine of what happens with the prostitute, the pre-folded towel, the baby in the room. And then he finds himself like there's almost this irony to him stumbling across the Russian roulette club, because it's the darkest thing. There's nothing trying to pull him in there. There's no reason why he should have found that. There's no reason why he wouldn't have stayed with the bright lights, but something dark kind of pulls him there. And then the irony being that Michael is also there, that these right. two people both found this place because something dark in them needed to both be there.
And watch it. I mean, it's weird because it's also like, if we take apart the coincidence of this movie, it's like, and that's why I think this movie is fantasy, right? It is just saying you have to leave your logic at the door. Like, how do these guys find each other in the middle of the Vietnam War? Why is Michael there in like civilian clothes watching this? Why would anyone who was subjected to this in a way that he was want to watch this for fun? You know, and I think the idea is, going back to this idea that it's almost you're drawn to it. This is what we're connected via Russian roulette. I think it's bullshit. I just call bullshit on it. It just feels like it feels slightly stupid to me. When you're watching the movie, it's like I buy what's happening, but when you think about it, you're like, really? Like, why would he ever want to watch that? After this is a guy who's not going to be able to shoot a deer. By the way, that deer, also not a deer, was an elk. No big deal. Another lie. Another lie. Michael Cimino, admit it was an elk, not a deer.
So we have basically the coolest guest of all time with us this week. We have Ruchiana Alda, who plays the bride Angela in this film. And Ruchiana, just as a backstory before we bring her in, she's fascinating. She was born in 1942 in Riga, Latvia. She spent her first years living in a refugee camp in Europe. You know, it was crowded. It was full of rubble, 2 million people. It was fascinating before making it to America, getting to Flagstaff, and then getting her way to New York to become an actress, where she studied with Stella Adler. She studied with Lee Strasberg. And she basically worked with everybody, every single big person from like the 60s and 70s. And she was there. Ruchiana was there. And now we get to talk to her about The Deer Hunter and just the 70s. Ruchiana, welcome to Unspooled. You have such an interesting backstory. I mean, you were born in Riga, Latvia during World War II. And from everything I've heard and, you know, read in your memoir, your first years were all about survival.
It was very stark. There's no way of getting around it. I mean, we lived in rubble, bombed out buildings with, you could see the sky, and it was very cold in the winter until we, you know, got a different kind of housing. And then we were lucky to wind up in the American zone because we got one little room the size of a big closet, which we were grateful for, and we had a bed along each wall or a mattress along each wall, and my grandmother's famous feather bed, which went with us everywhere.
So how does a girl in a refugee camp of 2 million people make it to doing theater in New York City?
Well, you know, I saw my very first movie when I was about 6 or 7 in the refugee camp. Actually, the sick children's, they sent me off to the sick children's camp. And so I saw my first film, which was a movie. I didn't know who Gary Cooper was at the time or Paulette Goddard, but they were in this Western. And I'd never seen a movie before, and I thought, oh, my God, there's a life out there. There's different. This is amazing, you know. So that never wavered. So when I came to America later, the refugees at that time, it was a different story because you came, you had to be sponsored by someone. So we were sponsored by the Presbyterian Church in Chicago, or Willamette, Illinois, outside of Chicago. And they had, before you came, you had to have a job because at that time you could not go on any public assistance. If you went on any public assistance for at least 5 years until you became a citizen, you were deported back. So they found my stepfather a job in Flagstaff, Arizona. It was a little town at the time on Route 66 in the middle of Arizona. And so we were thrown into the small community. My stepfather and my mother worked at nights. And for a while, I was talking like Katharine Hepburn because for a while I was seeing a lot of her movies. So people thought, oh, I've become affected. But I wasn't affected. It was just that I was, you know, catching the ear. But that was my love of movies never left me. My wanting to be a storyteller. So the moment I graduated from Flagstaff, I went to, at that time, the best teachers, acting teachers, were in New York. So I went to New York on $200 and a suitcase. I signed up to study with Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler, Sandy Meisner, all the great teachers of that time. I studied with them all.
That's what I love about this early part of your career is, like, you saw everything, you met everybody, like, you just bore witness. I mean, you were everywhere. You were even, like, Mia Farrow's body double stand-in on Rosemary's Baby, which
Rosemary's
I can't.
Rosemary's Baby with Roman.
What was that set like?
Well, you know, it was Roman at that time was very intense. I don't know if he still is, but it was a very intense set. In the movie, the scene is cut out, but in the movie, when it starts, this girl in the front of the Dakota, the famous building, she jumps out of the top floor and commits suicide. So they were arranging, you know, the body double and everything, and Roman was very upset that there wasn't enough blood. So he grabs the blood bottle out of the guy's hand. He said, "More blood! I want more blood! More blood! More blood! More blood!" And he took over, and everybody's like, "A little, what is he doing?" You know, it was really he really shaped that movie. I got to say, he made that movie great. However, John Cassavetes totally hated him because he didn't let John felt he didn't let him really create the character and give a reasonable explanation of why he lets Mia, you know, into this devil group. But I must say, I've got to hand it to Polanski that he made a terrific film.
And you got to play these like roles in creating these gigantic set pieces. I mean, the wedding in The Deer Hunter just seems absolutely outrageous. It seems like amazing that you guys pulled it off. I mean, could you walk me through the sequence? Like, how long are you practicing? How long are you learning the dances? How long are you staging everything? How many days are you wearing a wedding dress?
Well, that wedding dress, by the way, never got dry. We were in the middle of a heat wave. It was like 120 degrees.
Oh, my God.
During the whole shoot. So they tried to dry it, but I would get into that wedding gown. It was damp every day. You know, that scene, about a week or two into the filming, the big guys came down on him. We got shut down for a day or two, at least a day, maybe two, and we thought we weren't going to make it the movie but they felt Michael was being excessive in the wedding scene and excessive in this. And in fact, later on, they tried to release the movie without the wedding scene. Didn't work.
How would you even make this movie without the wedding scene?
They cut it down to nothing. Of course, when you cut the wedding scene down to nothing, all the characters get established in the wedding scene. Well, the dances, we went to learn these three Russian dances with this dance teacher that has a company in Cleveland. They do these Russian dances. And she said to us, these take months to learn. We're not going to, we said, let's let Michael send us here for 4 hours, 5 hours to learn these dances. So she said, okay, well, because she was getting paid, so she said, all right. At night in the hotel, we would pair up in the hallways of the hotel, and we would do these dances over and over again. Chris was the easiest to learn because Chris was a dancer, Chris Walken. He was a dancer, so he got things really quickly. But the rest of us, we really were almost all night doing these dances. And so the teacher that taught these dances was amazed that we got these dances right. And I said to Michael afterwards, I said, here's what she said. She said we couldn't do it. It would take us months. And yet we did it. And I said to him, how did you know we would get it done? He said, oh, I had total faith in you. I just knew you would do it. And so there was a trust there from Michael. He trusted us. He was into letting moments happen. You know, he wanted these moments to happen. The only time I ever saw him lose it was because we were waiting. We were working these long hours, 18 hours. So we were all tired. But when John Savage and I drink from the cup, the wine.
Yeah.
They had weeks to work on that scene, the special effects people, to make sure that whatever they did, the drop would drop. Well, we went to shoot it and it didn't work. And we were shooting in the 17th hour or something.
The drop wasn't dropping? Was that you, your chest, your dress? Were they zooming
in?
Yeah,
that was the wedding dress.
Yeah.
There was the last scene we shot of the wedding. And so the drop wouldn't drop, and Michael lost it. He said, if this was Francis Ford Coppola, he said, you had weeks to get this right. You had weeks to do it. If this was Francis Ford Coppola's set, you would be done perfectly. And you guys have really screwed this up. And he went on and on, and I stood there, because he had to vent. It was the last scene. And it didn't work. Michael calmed down. I said, Michael, this is important to the scene. He said, yes, it's so important. This sets the whole thing. And I said, let's maybe we can get a dropper. And Michael, you can drop the drop on the dress. And he said, that's not the way I wanted to do it. That's not the way we wanted to shoot it. And I said, I know, but we don't have time to make it work. It's not going to work. He said, I know. So I said, okay. So Michael actually stood above me on a ladder and dropped that drop at the exact time that he wanted it dropped.
I'm just picturing Carrie for some reason.
So he dropped the drop and it worked perfectly, and that was like our 19th hour. But so he had he didn't want to compromise. If he had a vision, you see, he wanted to do his vision. He wanted to be true to his vision.
I can't imagine how hard it must have been for all of you when John passed away.
Well, it was a shock because the rumor is, which is not true, because I had intimate talks with John. Johnny and I, he really thought he beat the cancer. He didn't. He said, you know, I'm so happy I beat it. Everything's fine. I'm fine. And his goal was to stop everybody from smoking. That was his. He saw anybody with a cigarette. He said, you've got to stop. Look what happened to me. And I beat it, but I'm fine. So it wasn't, the story is that poor John Cazale went through this thing with his cancer. And isn't this awful? We felt so sorry for him. No, Johnny was great. Johnny was healthy during that time. And he still, well, the cancer returned with a venom, I think, right after I saw him, probably sometime in January. And he passed very quickly in a matter of a couple of months. I mean, it just returned really fast. But when we worked on Deer Hunter, he wasn't like, oh, poor Johnny Cazale. He's like, no, he had more energy than a lot of people. He was like, and he was having fun. He was having the time of his life. So, in fact, he was teasing me. He said, that baby was mine. That was my baby, because, you know, the whole thing about we don't know which. He said, it was you and me, kid. It was you and me. We had to. And, you know, he was just a wonderful person. I mean, I can't, just a regular guy, really, honestly.
Also, on the baby note, I mean, there's so much in your scenes that we're supposed to pick up from just sort of inference from watching. You know, this is a film that really, like, trusts the viewer to kind of understand what's going on inside all these people. But to you, as you were playing Angela, the way you approached it, how do you think she felt about this shotgun wedding?
Well, I played it like this is I love Johnny Savage too, and they're going off to war, and I better have a father here. So, and he's the only one that asked me. I thought of it as a sweet romance, like when you have a little high school romance and it's innocent and it's sweet and somebody has a crush on you. And I played it like my character, that John Savage's character had a crush on me. We were like really kind of like little sweethearts, but we never had, you know, like John says to Bobby, I never had sex with her. So, but in spite of that there was a love that these two people had for each other, and she had to get married because where was she going to go? She had no parents. She had nothing in this small little town, so at least she would have something. And I think in a way, what John Savage's character probably thought that too, at least he would provide for her, and living at the mother's house and provide for her in terms of his, whatever his little salary was from the army. So, I mean, I sort of thought of it that way.
Can I admit something maybe a little silly to you, which is that Christopher Walken in this film is basically the most attractive man I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, oh boy, was he. He was the height of his beauty.
Oh, my God.
I mean, gorgeous. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting because the PR person thought it was going to be John Savage that was going to get the nomination for the Best Supporting Actor. But a lot of his stuff was cut out. A lot of his stuff, especially in the Vietnam sequences, was cut out because whatever reason, you know, Michael, who knows. But, yeah, Christopher was at his most gorgeousness, absolutely. Just look at him, you think, oh, my God, that is gorgeous.
Yeah, one of the first episodes we did on this show is we did Platoon, which, you know, and everything I was reading it from the articles at the time, people were like, this is the film where Vietnam veterans were really able to talk about their war experience. But, I mean, Deer Hunter comes out years before. Like, didn't Deer Hunter add something to the conversation?
Oh, no, it absolutely did. I remember they sent us out to different cities to premiere the movie. I was sent back to Cleveland to premiere the movie as a guest. And I have never had the response that I had, because a lot of veterans came. I've never had the response I've ever had from another movie like I had this one. Veterans lined up. They were in tears. They were thanking me for making the movie. Of course, it was Michael, but they were saying thank you. This really, one woman came up to me. I'll never forget. She said, "Just, you know, I was there for several hours." So, she said, thank you so much. And I said, well, you know, I'm just part of the cast. No, she said, thank you because my husband has never talked to me about his Vietnam experiences until tonight. And tonight he started talking to me, and he was crying and sobbing on my chest. And she said, this is a breakthrough for me and my family and my relationship with him.
Wow.
It was such a powerful evening. I've never, ever, ever had that experience.
Oh, Regina, before we go, I just want to say, like, what really knocks me out about your career is just that you have done so much. You know, you've done over 100 roles on camera. You've done so much theater. When I've read interviews with you saying about, like, why, like, what's driven you, the thing you say is that it's because when it came to acting, you never felt like you had a second choice, a second option, anything you'd rather do. To which I just want to say, like, really?
Yeah, really. You know, I did a lot of jobs. Believe me, I drove a cab. I was one of the first women cab drivers at night. I worked in restaurants. I did conventions. I did stuff, you know, because I needed to make money to pay my rent. So I did a lot of this. But at one point when I was doing some miserable job, which I think I got fired from, I said, oh, my God, is there anything I want to do? I'm having such trouble making a living. And I searched this, and I said, there's nothing I want to do. So even when I was driving a cab, I remember one night over the Manhattan Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge, I said to myself, this is not forever. This is not forever. I'm not driving this cab forever. Something will happen. And then something did happen.
Oh, Regina, I don't even have words for how fun it has been to talk to you. This has just been so, so great.
Oh, it's wonderful, Amy. Well, Tanya Alda is a person who's been around for a while. There I am, and I enjoyed sharing some moments of my life with you. So, thank you.
That was so, 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 so much fun talking to her. I want to ask her like a bazillion questions and hear literally every story. But luckily for us, Rudana is writing a one-woman show about her life. She's working it now. She's submitting it to Sundance. I'm going to cross all my fingers that we get to see her perform the play about her awesome life. And also, if you don't want to wait for that, The Mommy Dearest Diary, Carol Ann Tells All, her memoir of her time on the set of Mommy Dearest, is out now. Thank you again so much, Rudana. This was awesome.
All right, so Amy, we know that this movie is a hit, right? It makes $49 million. You know, it's a success. It's the biggest success that Cimino has. And we've talked a little bit about the Oscars. Tell me about what's going on Oscar night and how this everything is getting received.
Well, there's two things I think are particularly interesting. Like, one, the person who presents the Best Director Award to Michael Cimino is actually Francis Ford Coppola, who's like in process of Apocalypse Now. He gives the award to a guy who's already making like a dirty apocalyptic Vietnam film. And I wonder how he felt, like, man, is there going to be room for my film?
Right.
Or was he like, thank you for making room for my film?
Or maybe he says, I'm going to make my film more, you know, fantastical to stay away from this. I mean, I think Apocalypse Now is a very conscious choice to do a Vietnam film in a very different way.
It's true. I wonder that. And also, another presenter that night was John Wayne. And this is important for a couple of reasons. Like, one, we know that John Wayne hated these kind of war movies, because if John made a war picture, it was going to be more like Green Beret. It was going to be like more, here's what America did right completely. Mm-hmm. It was going to be heroic. And so John Wayne presenting the award to this, there's a little bit of like darkness there. And it's an interesting moment because this is actually, I think, even John Wayne's very last performance in public.
Oh,
the
wow.
very last time he spoke in public, because he was really sick. He dies 2 months later. Everybody knows he's really sick. When he walks out, they even build it up a little bit. They show this clip of Bob Hope from the Oscars the year before saying he wishes that John Wayne would be there, but John Wayne was sick.
Oh, wow.
And then when John Wayne finally does come out, when he walks in, he gets the standing ovation before he gives out Best Picture. I think like the more we do the show, the more fascinated I am in the Oscars of the 70s. Because you really do have this passing of the old guard, an ascension of the new guard, and these mashups of like veteran performers next to like Ally McGraw.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating. Like, I would love to just hang out at that Oscars that whole decade and just observe everybody. You're in this crossroads. It reminds me of like when you're in Istanbul and you're at the airport, it's like literally the most crossroads of the world I've ever been at. And the 70s feel like that. The 70s Oscars feel like that.
But do you feel like it's more aggressive because they're seeing like the death of their era And like, it's almost like, get, it's a gentrification. It's like, get out of here, old people. We're taking over now. You know, it's like there is like a little bit of your time is over.
I mean, that is how I felt with that Astaire tap dance.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to take a moment here to do a segment on the show that I like to call Dustin Hoffman Corner. Every now and then we like to take a moment to knock DH down a peg. And this week I thought you would like it, especially because did you know the reason why Meryl Streep was in Kramer versus Kramer was because she was freshly grieving the death of her love, John Cazale, who's in this film. And he felt like she was going to be able to bring a vulnerable woman in crisis tone to the character. So he basically hired her to manipulate her emotions at that moment, which got her nominated for an Oscar. And she was in the same year nominated for Best Lead Actress. She lost to Maggie Smith and won Best Supporting Actress for Kramer versus Kramer.
I mean, that's just Hoffman, again, never trusting that other people can act.
Right.
That's also the movie where he slapped her in the face because he wasn't sure that she would like show the proper emotion and she got really mad.
What if Dustin Hoffman played the part of John Cazale in this movie? That would have been interesting. Or Michael. I would have liked to have seen two really alpha guys go at it. What kind of movie would that have made? So I know, Amy, you said that this film had mixed reviews. We read a couple of them. Is there anything else that you want to kind of pull from?
Well, you know, nobody writes a pan like Pauline Kael.
Hmm.
And to back up a little bit, I think a lot of why this film got the positive reviews that it did, part of it, is because Star Wars had just come out, made $1 billion. And mm-hmm. I think critics were in a moment kind of like they are now, where we're like, we must defend art against blockbusters.
Okay.
And so I do think there was a little bit of this undercurrent of like, we must say that three hour long epics are art and not Star Wars.
Right.
Try to like draw this divide. So I think that is a lot of the backdrop here of what's happening. But Pauline Kael and Andrew Serres, two people who are always at each other's throats, both hated this. Andrew Serres called it, quote, massively vague, tediously elliptical, and mysteriously hysterical. And he had this line, once more, the outline for a great film has been mistaken for the actual achievement of the film itself. And because when this film came out, actually, nobody was completely sure yet that Russian roulette wasn't real. It was a little bit of like Blair Witch-esque.
Right.
You know, people weren't totally sure what was right. Like, it took a couple of years for the research to really come out. So he was confused about that. But Kael, I got to read a Kael pan. You ready?
Yes.
This movie, with its monumental romanticism and its striving for a symphonic shape, is sexually impacted. It has the celibacy of football players before the big game, and it attaches it to Vietnam. The hero and his friends are as chaste as Norman Rockwell Boy Scouts. They're the American cousin of hobbits. Which, wow. She said that we're made to feel that what we see is all these men are, and that a great director would plant doubts in us. You know, she thinks Cimino sees like the small town people as too small town.
Yeah.
And she says that when Cimino wants to make a point, it's usually an outsized point, a portent or an omen that reeks of old movie infantilism. She kind of likes the scene where he plays the Chopin Nocturne at the bar right before they all go to Vietnam. But she has this observation I think is really smart. She says, if only one of the men had fallen asleep, the scene might have been as great as it wants to be. But with all of them demonstrating their innate sensitivity, showing us that beer slosher savage beasts are soothed by music, it's too much like those scenes in which roomfuls of Hitler's lieutenants all swooned to Wagner.
Yes.
I love
yes.
the line because it's a little bit like also our whole opera thing that's yes. been going on since Shawshank. And then she says that the town is too uncontroversial about its politics and that when it comes to Robert De Niro and Streep, he seems so wishy-washy about her feelings for her that, quote, he was hotter for the deer.
Hmm.
And then she ends by getting a lot into the politics of the film and the racism. And she says, the film seems to be saying that the Americans had no choice, but the Viet Cong enjoyed it. And Michael, the transcendent hero, is a hollow figure. There is never a moment when we feel, oh, my God, I know that man. I am that man.
Yes, yes, yes. That review hits it right on the head for me. I think the easy way out is to be like, well, we're not trying to talk about Vietnam. We're not trying to talk about violence. We're just telling the story. But I don't think the story is good. And I don't think that the message is good. And I think that that's what, you know, but I think there are great scenes. There are great performances.
You know what is fascinating, though, about reviews of this movie when it came out?
What?
Is that most of the ones I read said it was a homoerotic film, which had never occurred to me until I read these reviews.
Do you think that people are kind of piggybacking on Deliverance at this point?
And I think that somebody referred to the Schlesingerness. Edness of it, thinking about Midnight Cowboy, maybe because you have a tall blonde Christopher Walken and a shorter dark haired guy. I don't know what it is, but everybody thought that Robert De Niro's character was gay.
Well, they say he's gay, but I think he's just in love with Meryl Streep. I mean, that's what we're led to believe, that he's like watching her from across the bar. Like, he is in love with her, but it's his best friend's girl. He couldn't get with her.
You know, when I rewatched the movie after I read these, I'm like, okay, I can kind of see that there's bits where, like, is he looking at Meryl or is he looking at Christopher Walken? You're not entirely sure. And there is that bit where John Cazale says that, like, he's been trying to hook him up with women and he won't be with women.
But I think that that's him acting out because he just got humiliated by De Niro. Like, and I feel like that is kind of reactionary, you know, gay panic. Like, here's a movie about a bunch of dudes who have feelings. You know, why are they hanging out with each other all the time? Why aren't they just fucking girls? And that guy didn't fuck, you know, I'm sorry using fuck so many times. That guy didn't have sex with his wife and she's pregnant. Like, there's a lot of these things. Like, why are they all together? I think that just feels like at that point we may not have been used to those kind of relationships. And maybe that's the beginning of that kind of relationship.
I can hear that argument. I can absolutely hear that argument. Although I was thinking, like, there is also the argument that we didn't really have openly gay characters in the 70s, and so maybe people were used to looking for subtext, where now we're sort of more comfortable with the idea that, well, wouldn't you just say so? So I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting at least to see that those are the glasses people had on when they watched it.
Yeah, I totally agree. But before we get to The Simpsons, I want to ask you, do you think this film belongs on the list of 100 best films ever made?
Nah.
I honestly agree with you. Nah. Nah. And I say it, like, I say it in the way that, you know how I reacted to Ben-Hur. I was like, nah, I could make a case for Ben-Hur on the list more than I can make a case for this. In the grand scheme of what it represented and the way the story was told, I really reacted negatively to it. I'm glad that I saw it. I'm glad that I've seen some of these performances. I'm glad that now I know what this movie is. On that note, is there a Simpsons?
Why, yes, there is. This is from an episode called Simpson Tide, in which Homer decides to join the Navy. He goes to Moe's bar to tell Moe that he's joining the Navy, and everybody decides to pool together, and then you learn something very sinister about Moe's bar.
Well, guys, I won't be seeing you for a while.
Where are you going?
I've joined the Naval Reserve.
Well, I'm not going to let anything happen to my best friend. I'm joining, too.
Well, I'm not going to let anything happen to my two best customers. I'm joining, too.
And although my religion strictly forbids military service, what the hey, I'm in, too.
Gee, thanks, guys. This is just like the Deer Hunter.
The Deer Hunter? That reminds me. Didimo! I'm sorry, guys. We're shutting down for a while. Sorry.
So what you didn't see there was that Krusty the Clown is playing a game of Russian roulette in the back room of Moe's. That's pretty great. So, Amy, I know we really dug into it. This is a fascinating conversation with you. And now I ask you, what is next on the list?
I almost feel a little bit bad about it, but 303 and 303, we are gonna do Gone with the Wind.
Oh, so long, so long. Why are you doing this to me in the middle of summer? I have friends, I have barbecues.
Well, you know what, Paul? You can roast your weenies on the burning of Atlanta.
Okay, all right. Well, Amy, what do we want to tell people to do? The call to action for next week. What do we want to make it? And obviously, you know, there's some pretty famous lines in Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, I kind of want to hear people just say, frankly, my dear, I don't give a blank. Fill in the blank.
That's much better than what I wanted to do, which was just have people say, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, but in the Borat voice. why don't you give us a call at 747-666-5824 and give us your frankly, my dear, I don't give a... And you fill in the blank. That's 747-666-5824. Leave it there. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a blank. It's just like Match Game, but with me and Amy and no Alec Baldwin. All right. we will see you next week for Gone with the Wind, where all movies are available. I mean, you'll have no trouble finding Gone with the Wind anywhere. All right. See you next week, Amy.